Welcome to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. Our team's goal is to present science-based information about gardening and all things nature in New York's Hudson Valley. Hosts Gene and Tim, along with team members
Teresa, Linda, and Annie,
are master gardener volunteers for New York's Columbia and Green Counties. So if you're interested in gardening or nature or nuggets of information about what's happening outside your door, settle in. Enjoy the conversation. Whatever the season, we have something to say.
Hi, I'm Tim Kenalty.
And I'm Jean Thomas.
And welcome to Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. We're here at the Cornell campus in Ithaca on our road trip.
And our guest today is Christy Sullivan. Christy's the director of the New York Master Naturalist Program, which may be new to some of you. Christy, we want to hear all about the program, but first we'd like to hear a little bit about your background and how you ended up involved in the program.
Well, first, thank you very much for having me and giving me this opportunity. I became interested in this topic area. Mostly, I'm a trained wildlife biologist, and I've never been able to really just nail it down to just one species or one group of organisms. I've always been interested in kind of a whole systems approach. So as I was developing my career here at Cornell, I started becoming aware of other master naturalist programs throughout the country. And I thought, wow, what a great opportunity to connect with other individuals who also really enjoy just being outdoors and learning about the various groups of organisms and how everything fits together and the conservation issues that affect our natural systems. So I decided to give it a try and see if it would be popular here in New York State.
So you started the Master Naturalist Program in New York State?
I did.
How long ago?
Well, I piloted it in 2010 just to see if there was very much interest, and there was. So I took a year off to find some funding and then started it in earnest in 2012.
Wow, that's excellent. See, I took the Master Naturalist training and I didn't even realize that. That's how we do this podcast, so we learn more things, right? No, that's excellent. Tell us more about, like, are there other Master Naturalist programs in the country that you said you studied some? Do most states have them? Do they work similarly?
Not all states have them, but quite a few do, and they really vary. So when I was kind of researching it, I found there are some states that have very well-developed, very large programs. So for instance, Texas has a very large program. Virginia has a pretty large program. And they may even have like a central overarching organization and then chapters throughout the state. Some are funded by universities, some are funded by the state wildlife agencies, and some are funded by a variety of different organizations.
I mean, the thing that I loved about the training was that you leveraged all these experts from Cornell, because it's done at the Arnett Forest, right, in Ithaca. And so all these folks came, and it's so varied in terms of, I remember there was a topic on ferns, and there was one on bears, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes, I'm very fortunate to be here at Cornell and have such wonderful colleagues who are willing to donate their time and energy to teach people. And, you know, they're very enthusiastic and passionate about what they do. And I think that really inspires people to learn and to do good work themselves.
And it's statewide. So if you live in Buffalo and you want to do this, you're coming to Ithaca, right?
Yes, absolutely. I have done a few regional trainings in cooperation with some of the county extension associations. But for the most part, the annual training is held at the Arnott Forest near Ithaca.
When I'm researching things, I often trip over references to DEC information that overlaps and coordinates with a lot of the things you're doing. Do you have a formal connection back and forth where you can pool resources?
We don't have a formal relationship with DEC. I do promote a lot of volunteer efforts in association with DEC. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, there are people who do a lot of work with invasive species. Some of the volunteers do. And so a lot of those things involve DEC in some way or bat surveys. So there are volunteer opportunities that the volunteers engage with that are led by DEC, but I don't have any formal relationship with DEC for this program.
So there's overlap.
Yet.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
We're master gardeners, and I'm a master forest owner. tell us, what does it mean to be a master naturalist? Because it may be a new term to people.
Okay, well, master naturalist is, you know, someone who goes through the required training and then has to pursue some additional training on their own and some volunteer hours. And they really have the opportunity to either do on-the-ground conservation work, and that can be some sort of management or restoration or active conservation, or they can do outreach. A lot of people are very talented and very interested in sharing their knowledge with others, so outreach is also a possibility. And volunteers get to choose the type of work that they do based on their interests and their expertise, and they also get to choose who they work with, who they volunteer for to receive those hours. So all in all, they volunteer with probably over 100 different organizations, agencies, or programs within agencies across the state.
Okay, so in New York, we have master naturalists, we have master forest owners, we have master gardeners. Do they have training in common? Is their format the same, or has each one sort of developed organically and differently from all the others?
For the most part, they're different, and they've developed organically. I can't say that I'm 100% on top of what the master gardener and master forest owner trainings are like. I do know that master forest owner program went to more online training in recent years. And I also kind of evolved to starting with COVID in terms of adding some online elements to the training when we were limited. And I've retained those elements afterwards. So it's kind of been developing over time and expanding.
But the initial training's in person, right, at the Arnott. And talk a little bit about that. It's a 2 or 2.5 day, or it seemed longer to me, even though I liked it a lot.
That's funny, because other people have asked for it to be longer.
Oh, okay.
Well, you lucked out.
Yeah, so the in-person training is required, and that's really important for the Master Naturalist program, because most people are getting involved because they want to learn to be able to identify more things and to see things happening on the ground, to understand what the effects are. So I feel like that's a critical element of the training. The training begins on a Friday afternoon, and it goes until Sunday afternoon. We go till pretty late in the day. Each day it's packed. And there's a combination of some indoor presentations, but mostly outdoor sessions where potential volunteers get to learn about everything from amphibians and reptiles to invasive species. There's an insect part. There's some volunteer opportunities. They get to actually practice there on the ground. So there's a whole variety of different topics.
Okay, so I want to be master naturalist. What do I have to do to be accepted into the program? Is there a fee? Is there an admission test? Like, I have to have an IQ of some level. What's required to become a volunteer?
Yeah, that's a great question, Gene. So it used to just be that you would apply and, you know, you would either get in or you wouldn't. And then at some point, the demand became so high that I would open the application, and within a few hours, the program would be full, because I only accept about 30 people each year. And that's because when you're outside, you know, you want everyone to have a good quality experience. And if there are too many people, they don't get to see things. So at some point, people started becoming a little upset about this. They had tried, you know, they were at work when the announcement came out and they didn't get to apply. So I started a few years ago, I started an application process where everybody, there's an online application. It opens in June. You apply, and then I choose from those people. And that was beneficial for a number of reasons. And the other thing is that it enabled me to help diversify the program. So I was able to ask questions about their geographic location and gender and race and level of education. And I've been working hard to try to select to have a more diverse cohort than might have been possible before.
So if there were 3 or 4 of you, you could do 3 or 4 times as many people getting trained.
There could. Well, if there was 3 or 4 times as much money, then I could.
It's all about the money.
There's it's all about the rub.
Money.
Okay.
Right, yeah. I mean, it's important to me not to accept too many new people each year also, because I need to fulfill the needs of those volunteers throughout the year, and I don't want to water down their experience. Yeah. They're out there doing good work, and I want them to feel like they're seen and appreciated for what they're doing. And if there are too many people, then that could affect that experience.
I mean, my memory of the training was that the group was really diverse. I mean, not just geographically, but just kind of their background and their expertise or lack thereof, or their interests. I mean, there were some people who are more interested in plants and invasives and people who are kind of reptile specialists. So that was great because I felt like I was learning from those people, and very, very engaged, super engaged people, which was wonderful, really. And from the experiences in the training, I mean, the two things that I remember too were baby turtles. We found some turtle nests and there were all these baby turtles, which was very cool. And I also remember, and I think you did this, we did owl calling at night.
Yes.
You wouldn't think I would like that, would you? But I did. It was great. It was a little scary, but we did owl calling, right?
Yes. And we're usually pretty successful. They're very vocal. There are quite a few owls out there.
Oh, they are. They never shut up at my house.
So what happens then after the training? Okay, I've taken the training and I've had this great experience and I obviously have to fulfill some requirements. I'm not a master naturalist automatically. I have to do some things after I've taken the training. The training is one piece, right?
Yes. So the training's one piece and it counts for 16 hours of training. We also have some online sessions now that are included in what's required. And some webinars you need to view and that type of thing. And some other sessions where we bring some speakers in and the participants get to ask them questions. But after the initial training, which counts for 16 hours, then you can, you're required to fulfill 14 additional hours of training. And that can be, it's on your own and it can be any topic that you're interested in. Some individuals like to focus on one topic area. Other people like to get a little smattering of all different types of things. And so that format allows people to kind of pursue their own interests, but also allows them to control future costs. So essentially after the initial training, you could do the rest of your 14 hours and not have to pay anything. So it gives some flexibility there. And then in addition to the training hours, so that would be a total of 30 training hours, then they have to pursue 30 hours of volunteer work. And that, again, can be in any topic area, and the individuals get to decide for themselves what they would like to do. You know, some people just need a target to hit so that very quickly they become a master naturalist. And so we created additional levels to help those people, you know, some people just really like that, to help those people to be able to aspire to more greatness. So from level 2 to 10, then 8 hours of additional training and 20 hours of volunteer work are required to achieve each new level. And then it doubles after level 10 and doubles once again after level 20. And it goes all the way up to level 30. We have somebody achieving level 29 right now. Wow. And so at level 30, that's going to be the highest level possible. But every time a volunteer achieves a level, they get a certificate and a nice pewter wildlife or plant pin or something that recognizes their efforts.
Okay, I got a question about who these people are. You say you're looking for diversity, but is there a common thread through all these people? I mean, obviously they're interested in nature, but are you finding any other commonality among them?
Yes, that's a good question. Something I noticed pretty early on is that some people are very well-respected professionals in their own field, and some people are just interested in sharing it information with their grandchildren, teaching them about nature, or homeschooling. So people come to the program for a variety of different reasons. But I do notice that there are a lot of people in the healthcare field who also are interested in the Master Naturalist program. And the only thing I can think of there is that they're people who like to nurture by nature. Yeah. And so they also have, you know, this affinity for helping nature or you know, helping to conserve our environment. Or, for example, some people, there was someone who participated who worked with head trauma victims and, you know, used nature as therapy. So for health benefits. So that's another connection maybe with the medical field. But so that is something that I've noticed. But otherwise, there's a diversity. Some people just are very connected with their own land or land in their community and want to learn more. But it really varies.
And then each individual, once they've got their training, has their own path already that is what they want to do, and that's why they took the training, like you say, for their own property or for being a caregiver.
Yes. You know, some people kind of have a clear path already established in their minds, or they're heading in a clear direction and they have a reason why they want to learn more. And some people just come because they're interested and they're not quite sure what they're going to do with it yet. And so that's where, you know, we need to help them out a little bit more in terms of connecting them to local organizations that they might volunteer with and helping them to kind of discover their path.
And can you give us some examples of some of the projects people have worked on in the last few years?
Sure. So it's highly varied, but there's a lot of opportunity to engage with invasive species issues, for example. So some people do hands-on invasive species control or education or monitoring for hemlock woolly adelgid, for example, or the spotted lanternfly is something quite a few volunteers are working on right now. Other people are very interested in wildlife. So DEC has these driving acoustic bat surveys that you can
That's
do at night.
That's my favorite. I remember that.
Yes.
That's
what,
great.
You eavesdrop on bats?
See,
yes,
Jean, this is something we could do together. You drive around
I
could
like
for
that.
Bats.
Yeah.
Yes, you have a bat detector on top of your car.
And do you get a bat signal?
You do, actually.
Yeah.
You get a bat signal.
See, you would do it, Jean, definitely.
Yes. I would.
Yeah. But you have to, the trickiest part is you have to drive at 18 to 21 miles an hour.
Oh, my car can't
it's,
do that.
It's very hard to do. Yeah. That is the hardest part. So yeah, so there's bat surveys. There's somebody right now is doing waterfowl surveys, weekly waterfowl surveys at Montezuma National Wildlife Refuge. And there's somebody who works, who volunteers at the Albany Pine Bush, working on Karner blue butterfly habitat restoration. Really a variety of things. And there are also opportunities for any of the citizen science projects that are out there. A lot to do with birds, so Project Feeder Watch or things like that. Just using eBird, I don't know if you're familiar with the eBird app, but you can basically just go out and document species that you see or hear and enter it, and then those data are used by scientists all over the world. So even if you can't connect with an organization locally, there are things that you can do just on your own to satisfy the requirements. Other things are like creating pollinator gardens or pollinator habitats is a popular one. We've done, as a group, a couple volunteer weekends focusing on riparian buffer restoration, so planting trees next to streams to help improve water quality and things like that.
And it's statewide, so you have people all over the state. So is there less of a natural community? Because, I mean, I think of the master gardeners, and they're by county, so it's those folks who are living in proximity to each other. But is there some community to the program as well?
Yeah, that's something that I started realizing a few years back, that, you know, there were sometimes people who were trained in different cohorts who were from the same area but had never had the opportunity to meet one another. So we started trying to form some groups, some regional, kind of regional action teams, I called them. So at this point, there is a very strong group that they call themselves Central New York Naturalists. And they do a lot of volunteering together. They've actually formed a very strong social group as well. And they do a lot of hemlock woolly adelgid monitoring. They teach birding by ear courses. So they have very, very strong group. A new one just started last year. There's Master Naturalist who's spearheading that in Western New York. So they're also trying to do some things together as a group, both socially and, you know, to go out and learn together.
I think we need to start one in the Hudson Valley, right?
Yes, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, we'll talk after, definitely,
yes.
Yeah.
Following along this, the master naturalist, we're finding out they're not necessarily hermits by nature, that they can socialize. And this program has been in place since what year?
We started in 2010. I did the first training,
okay.
Just a small pilot, and then went kind of gung-ho with it starting in 2012.
Okay, so how many active master naturalists are in the state right now? Ballpark.
Yeah. Okay, ballpark. So, well, we did reach a milestone with this last training in September, and that is that we reached over 500 people trained
since
the inception of the program.
Especially at 30 at a pop?
Yes.
Seriously?
Yes, yeah. So we have over 500 trained. How many are active really varies year to year, and I don't know if they're active unless they report what they're doing.
Oh, that's true. Like Tim.
Yes, right.
Right.
Like Tim.
I'm doing things,
he's doing things, but he's not telling me. Right. And people will say that I'm out
not
there doing things, but I just don't report.
Wow. I think we should end this interview now.
It's too late for you.
I'm sensing there's going to be a flood of
total
entries
total
coming into my database
so much from
you, Tim.
Me.
So I would say in any given year, maybe 100 are active at a time. But just because somebody is not active that year doesn't mean that they won't become active.
Right.
There are so many times where I've received emails, Christy, is it too late? I went through the training 3 years ago and life has been really hectic, but yeah. I just retired, or my young child just went off to school, or I just changed jobs and I'm feeling inspired to do more in nature.
So they're all potential.
They're all potential. And
yeah, nobody's inactive per se. They're just like Tim.
Right, right.
Wow, really. I think Christy's motto is it's never too late, right?
That's exactly it. Yeah. I tell people like Tim that it's never too late.
I'm the poster child for never too late.
Tim is the poster child. So Christy, if you had to ask a question of yourself about this, something that we may have forgotten or omitted, what would you want to tell everybody?
I guess I'd like to tell everybody that I guess what I value about the program most, or, you know, what makes me feel really good about it, is that with all the things that are going on in the world and all the conservation issues that we're facing, it can be really hard to stay positive. And one thing that really keeps me going personally is the volunteers, because I hear from them so often about what it means to them to participate in the program, to be out in nature, to be feeling like they're doing good things on the ground. And some of them really are absolutely spectacular. I mean, they put in a lot of energy and effort, and I know that they're making a difference on the ground and in their communities. And so that makes me feel really good about the program.
Tim has a traditional last question, and you just answered it.
Right. And I think almost more importantly, it's like you kind of hit on the theme that when we talk to a lot of people, whether they're master gardeners or master naturalists or anyone doing anything out in their property, is that you can make a difference. That little bit of, you know, whether you're doing something on some conservation land or you're doing something, you're planting natives in your garden, whatever, you can make a difference. And there's not that many things in the world where you can say you can make a difference, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I think that was a pretty darn good interview. Are we going to ask Christy back tomorrow?
Yeah, Christy's going to come back tomorrow. And we have many goodies. So she's going to come back tomorrow.
We have brownies.
I'm going to come back as soon as Tim puts a lot of entries into the database.
I'll tell you, never let this woman to the room again.
Good burn.
No, I'd like to say it was really nice having you, but I don't know.
Well, it's your conscience.
It was wonderful having you, and we learned a lot. And we hope you inspire a lot more people to join the program and do a lot more.
All right. Well, thank you very much for having me and for the opportunity to share about the Master Naturalist
program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes another episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. We would like to thank Sandra Powers and Devin Connolly from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties for production support. And a special thank you to our listeners for joining us on this episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. You can find links to any of the topics mentioned in this episode at our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org. Comments and suggestions for future topics may be directed to us at columbiagreenmgb@cornell.edu or on the CCE Master Gardener Volunteers of Columbia and Greene Counties Facebook page. For more information about Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, visit our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org or visit us in Hudson or in Acre. Cornell Cooperative Extension provides equal programming and employment opportunities.